Hello and welcome to this interview of the Lotus Eaters. I'm your host, Stelios, and I'm very pleased to be interviewing today Mr. Rob Herseth.
Hi, Stelios. Happy to be here. I just flew in from South Africa.
It's so nice of you to be here with us, and I'm really interested in interviewing you. And South Africa is a country about which I'm learning new things every day. And I think it's going to be a very educational experience for me. We have some concerning news every now and then, so it seems like some things aren't going well there.
Things are not well, as Shakespeare would say, in the state of Denmark. Things are not well in South Africa at all. In fact, it's reached a point where things have to crack.
Yeah,
things have to break for us to actually fix the situation.
I suppose my first question is, what was growing up in South Africa like?
Okay, so I was born in 1960 in Johannesburg to a loving mum and dad and a very wealthy family. So I was the lucky sperm club. That's one way of putting it. I was born into great wealth in Johannesburg in the most beautiful country in the world. And it really is the most beautiful country in the world. And into a world that was, you know, unusual because we had the national government, a white government, that institute a policy called apartheid. And everyone's heard the word apartheid, but no one knows what it actually means. Apartheid means separateness. And the concept of apartheid was separate development. That was the basis of it. And if you roll back a couple of hundred years, the Dutch arrived in the Cape in 1650. Okay, remember the Mayflower reached America in 1620. The Dutch established a permanent station in the Cape in 1650, okay? So if we're settlers, we've been there a very, very long time. And the black tribes had moved south from East Africa, hundreds of thousand years before, and they too arrived in South Africa in their own time. And the two tribes, the white tribes and the black tribes, met more or less at the Fish River, which is about 700-800 kilometers north up the coast from Cape Town. And you can only imagine that, you know, the colonial powers that arrived in the Cape and then further up country in the Eastern Cape and Natal met people that didn't have the written word, you know, were massacring each other, very savage people, but also some very decent, nice tribes people. And the white and the black tribes worked together, fought each other, and eventually South Africa was created. The Union of South Africa was only formed in 1910. So it's a relatively new country. It was made up of different unions, federations. And where we got to was, there were many wars. There were the Anglo-Zulu Wars, where the British fought the Zulus, the main black tribe of South Africa. And there were the Anglo-Boer Wars, where the British fought the Afrikaners, or the people of Dutch, French, Huguenot heritage. So South Africa's been a warlike country with a lot of wars and problems for all of its history, including South Africa fighting in the First and Second World War on the side of the British and the Allies. And in 1948, for the first time ever, the Afrikaners, who were the majority of the white tribe at that point, came into power. And over the next 10, 12 years, they began to institute this policy of apartheid. And you can understand the intellectual side of it, if you're prepared to have an open mind, that there were these people, the black tribes, who were, I'm not going to use the word less civilized, but who were not as advanced as the white tribes by any means. You know, when they first met, there was barely had the wheel. They had, pretty basic tribal ways of living. They had no written word. And so there was a huge gap between the two civilizations. And we know one can catch up very quickly with education, with proper opportunity. But I think in the 1930s and 1940s, you know, the white rulers still felt that, you know, the black tribes hadn't reached a point where they were equal. And so this policy of apartheid was instituted, and it began in a very intellectual way, but then, as with many ideologies, ended up being you know, way more money spent on black kids and way less money spent on, sorry, way more money spent on white kids, way less money spent on black kids for education. And it didn't work out. And in 1985, the Afrikaner government decided, independently of what was going on, but pressure did come from international sanctions, that this was unsustainable. And by 1994, first democratic elections, Nelson Mandela's African National Congress, ANC, was elected. But growing up in Johannesburg in the 60s and 70s, and then being at school in South Africa and university was spectacular. You know, fantastic weather, huge opportunities, a great country. You know, I was very privileged, and I'm very fortunate to have such an extraordinary childhood and upbringing. I'm very grateful for it, and I don't take it for granted.
So you're raising all sorts of issues, and it seems to me that we can start drawing a picture of the Dutch Republic in the 1650s, having won the Habsburg Spain during the 80 Years' War, and then expanding and going to South Africa. And from my understanding, they didn't meet the tribes that now claim to be the indigenous tribes at the point. Who Correct. Did they meet? And they met the tribes, he said, 700-800 kilometers to the north. Yeah. Who lived there?
There were strandlopers, which is a direct translation as beach walkers, so nomadic individual people. There were the Khoisan, the original, very, I won't say primitive, it's a probably up, the word will trigger people and upset people, but people from a very ancient civilization that were really not even hunter-gatherers. They were just nomadic people that lived off the land. And the Portuguese, who had, you know, Vasco da Gama and had traveled south around the African continent, but hadn't stopped. These are beautiful old crosses that they'd put where they actually moored to pick up vegetables and food. They had faced up to the Khoisan in a few battles, but hadn't stayed in Africa. So the original people that the Dutch colonists discovered were the Khoisan.
Right. So you mentioned apartheid standing for separateness. And could you give us some examples of how was it to live under apartheid? How did the separateness manifest institutionally speaking, and also on a daily human level?
So I suppose the most egregious element of it was that all black citizens of South Africa had to carry a pass, a document, to say where they were from in South Africa, and that they were in white areas to work. Yeah. So at any time, a policeman could say, show me your pass, where it wasn't required of a white person. There were black schools, white schools. There were black hospitals, white hospitals. Transport was separate. Everything became separate. And, you know, there were those infamous signs that you can still see the photographs of from the old days of Slech Blancas, whites only, or blacks only. Beaches were separate, you know. Mm. Black people couldn't go to beaches that were reserved for whites only. It was a country of separateness, of separate development. And in the 1970s, 25% of the population of South Africa was white.
Yeah.
Today, it's 7%. So the population growth of the black people in South Africa has been exponential, whereas the white people has been, you know, not nearly as fast. And also a lot of the, I think a million of the 5 million white people that were around in the 1970s and 80s have left the country. Yes. Have emigrated. It's been terrible brain drain since the 1970s, because there was this issue of swart gevaar, which if you translate directly means black fear of the blacks. Swart gevaar. Yeah. There was the fear of the communists moving south through Africa in the 1970s and 80s. Then there was the fear of, you know, revolution. Then there was the fear of international sanctions. And all of a sudden, 1994, we had a democratic election, and Nelson Mandela and his ANC swept to power. And there was the Rainbow Nation, the great hope for South Africa.
Right. So I want to ask you a bit about Nelson Mandela. But before I ask you this, I have another question. To what extent did this happen to countries near South Africa, which raises fear exponentially? that the same thing can happen to South Africans, to white South Africans.
Yeah, so if you look at the colonies in Africa, there were the British colonies, East Africa, Kenya, there was Zambia, which was Northern Rhodesia, there was Rhodesia itself, and then there were the Portuguese colonies of Angola and Mozambique. And in 1975, there was a revolution in Portugal, and they pulled out almost overnight. They had a big military presence there, and overnight they pulled out. And those countries collapsed into communism, terrorism, and really horrific situations on our borders. So the South African military was in Southwest Africa, which is now called Namibia. And on that border, the Angolan border, the MPLA, which was the Russian-backed and Cuban-backed Marxist organization, fought against, within Angola, UNITA, which was South African and American-backed. And all of us, my age, went to the military. I spent 2 years as an infantry officer, 1983 and 1984, as did all my colleagues. You know, you were called up for national service. And we fought on the border of Namibia, or Southwest Africa, and Angola. Mozambique had also had a similar collapse overnight, people streaming across the border to escape. And that country melted down into a sort of Marxist-inspired morass. And Rhodesia stood firm. Rhodesia announced UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence. And there was the most extraordinary resistance against the oncoming onslaught of communism and all those things that we feared in the 70s and 80s. And they held out for a very long time. And eventually, Rhodesia went over to democratic and black rule. Mugabe came in, and we all know the story there, destroyed their economy. So South Africa was sitting there with a very large white population and large colored and Indian population. And I think it's important just to differentiate that there are 26 black tribes in South Africa, the biggest being Zulu and Xhosa. There are 24 other languages and black tribes, Sotho, Tswana, and Ndebele.
It's difficult to communicate.
It's complex. And in the white tribes, everyone thinks they're the Afrikaners and the English, the Anglos. But within the Afrikaners, there were obviously descendants of the Dutch, the French, and the German, the French Huguenots who were expelled from France.
Yeah, after the Edict of Nantes was revoked. Yeah.
And a lot of the names in South Africa, Duplessis, De Klerk, are obviously of French origin. That's where they come from. But on the Anglo-English-speaking side of the white tribes, there are all the other agglomerations, you know, the Jews that escaped Eastern Europe and Russia, people from England, the 1820 settlers, the Portuguese who'd come south from Angola and Mozambique. So South Africa is a very large country. It's half the size of Western Europe. It's twice the size of France. And it's a very complex country. So the sort of northeast of South Africa has really nothing to do with the Cape. They're very different. And there are many languages. Mm. Nice and complicated.
Nice. So you mentioned Nelson Mandela, but also communist infiltration in South Africa. Wasn't Nelson Mandela involved in communist activity and communist subversion before he was elected president after his 27 years in prison?
27 years. He went to prison 27 years as a terrorist.
Yeah.
Because he formed the military armed wing of the ANC, which is called Umkhonto weSizwe. Initials are MK. Now they reappear. Okay, so we'll just keep that in mind. He founded that. He went to jail, he was convicted, and he was given a fair trial.
Yeah.
And even though every organization that defends against, you know, these sort of situations decided not to pursue the South African courts because he was given a fair trial, he was jailed for being a terrorist, and that's what he was, a terrorist. But he was released prior to 1994, and having spent so much time in jail, he came out realizing the only way for this country to survive, to be fixed, to mend the wounds, was to be a conciliatory, spiritual, visionary leader of South Africa. And that he was. But in the basic mandate of the ANC was communism, elitism, and actually anti-white racism, which is now coming to the fore, which we'll talk about just now.
Of course. Right. So do you think that he was also sabotaged in that effort by his family environment. I've heard that his wife, during the end of his, the latter period of his imprisonment, was in favor of some very brutal practices.
Necklacing.
Yes, with black people who were suspected of being informants.
Correct. She was an absolute monster.
Yeah.
She was a Satan, a witch. And, you know, there's a one pretty main road in Johannesburg called the Winnie Mandela Drive. And it makes me sick when you think of the things that she promoted. There's a terrible form of killing in South Africa called necklacing, where people had tires thrown around them and it was satellite. They'd burn to death.
Yeah.
This is That's Winnie Mandela, Nelson Mandela's wife.
Yeah.
She was an absolute monster.
And you think that you claim that he was a pillar of stability throughout his rule?
Yes, because afterwards. I think having spent 27 years in jail, you know, he realized the only way to make this country work was to let bygones be bygones, focus on forward thinking. And even though the ANC had all the evil within it that is manifesting itself now, he held that back while he was in power. And he was followed by Thabo Mbeki, who, even though he had major faults, like saying that HIV and AIDS, you know, you couldn't cure them and they were meant to happen, and he was quite extraordinarily stupid when it came to things like that. The economy grew at 3 to 5% a year. We added 500,000 jobs a year, and and there was still meritocracy in the country. You know, businesses and state-owned enterprises were run by competent people who got the job done. And the country was trending in the right direction. But within the mandate of the ANC, all the evil was there, was being implemented, and has come to bear today.
So I think that in the Western mind, in the collective consciousness, that isn't particularly political and doesn't follow the politics of South Africa, there has been a sort of myth or story, let's say,
The
Mandela legend, according to which Nelson Mandela was a sort of saint-like figure, and ever since, everything has been great in South Africa. And if we fast forward to today, we've started listening about some really disconcerting stuff, like farm murders. Some people are talking about white genocide, and also complete and total infrastructural collapse.
All correct. All in place.
All in place. So could we fast forward to today and describe, let's start with infrastructure and then go progress to the
South Africa's falling apart.
Yes.
It's falling apart at the seams. All of the state-owned enterprises, Eskom, Electricity Supply Commission, we have up to 6 hours a day of blackouts across the country. Okay. Transnet, the rail network, is barely functional. Denel, we had one of the great arms exporters in the world, bankrupt. South African Airways was the best airline in Africa by far. As good as gone, as good as bankrupt. And these have been systematically destroyed by the ANC for two reasons. One, they break so they can steal. It's all about kleptocracy. And two, they've had this policy called cadre or cadre deployment, which Cyril Ramaphosa has been a fundamental proponent of cadre deployment. I think in 2005 was the first main committee meeting, although they were deploying loyalists well in advance of that, but it was accelerated from 2005 onwards into positions of power, not just in state-owned enterprises, but on our institutions of democracy and judiciary. So what happened was there's this concept called state capture, and it began in full force when this gangster called Jacob Zuma became president. And Jacob Zuma was in power until 2017. And from 2008 to 2017 saw the collapse of all of our state-owned enterprises, stolen to death, broken to death by incompetent people who were ANC loyalists. Secondly, laws have been implemented, not just under Jacob Zuma, but increasingly under our spineless current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, called Black Economic Empowerment. And even though that began in the 1990s and South Africa accepted it as empowering previously disadvantaged, what it's really turned into is theft. So 100 families have stolen over R1 trillion from the economy. So black economic empowerment hasn't empowered the broad-based black or previously disadvantaged population of South Africa. It's empowered 100 families. And the families are Cyril Ramaphosa, Patrice Motsepe, Mohsen Goshang. I can keep naming them. It's pretty obviously, it's pretty obvious who they are. And then there's a law which was signed into law by Cyril Ramaphosa in the last 12 months called Expropriation Without Compensation. And if you want to think of a more stupid name for a law, something that'll chase away all foreign direct investment, you'd call it expropriation without compensation. Everywhere in the world, you have expropriation with compensation. You know, if you want to build a railway or an airport, you've got to expropriate land from people, but it's with compensation. We have the morons of the ANC introducing EWC, and it scared away all foreign direct investment. So these people have destroyed our economy because they are kleptocrats, but they've done it through cadre deployment and putting incompetent or ineptocratic people in positions of power. We have no idea what they're doing. Break so they can steal. And there's deindustrialization. So fixed investment in South Africa is at about 15% of GNP. It should be at 25% for an emerging market. We are deindustrializing. And the final stat, if I can give you one more.
No, of course. Just
we are growing at 0.5% GDP and have been around there for the last 10 years. And our population growth is 2%. Every year we get poorer.
So GDP may be increasing, but GDP per capita is decreasing rapidly.
Correct, rapidly. But yeah. if you're growing at less than 1%, you're not growing. You're actually going backwards.
Yeah. So it seems like you are describing Jacob Zuma's coming in 2008 and saying, I'm going to capture the state. I'm going to put my people in the judiciary, in the
democratic institutions, everywhere. State-owned enterprises.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he created the sort of clientelist system.
Correct.
Where it's his family and other families.
Correct.
And the only way to enter government or do anything is by somehow
loyalty
to the
voting for the ANC, being part of the mafia cartel. But it's worse than that. It's not just incompetence and malevolence. At that level, they've also impoverished the country. Cyril Ramaphosa announced that he proudly, the government is paying 25 million people a 350 rand a month social grant, proudly. So he is impoverishing the country, making them dependent on the ANC, so they'll vote for the ANC. So he not only has this 100 families that are looting and stealing, but he has 25 million people desperate, relying on social grants.
It seems to me that this would not happen unless there was a sort of socialist ideological hegemony.
Correct.
In South Africa. When did this start? You said something about the 70s and 80s, but was it...
In the 1960s was the first proper document put together called the National Democratic Revolution.
Yes.
I was nervous of things that come in three letters, DEI, CRT, ESG,
yeah.
You know. And then the National Democratic Revolution was put in place. And that document has been instituted over the next, 60 years, 50 years. And it's manifesting itself right now with the collapse of the economy, the collapse of our democratic institutions. And, you know, we are facing ruin. But let me give you a quick electoral history. The ANC has been in power since 1994. With the majority. In 2024 in May was the first time they lost their majority. They fell from 56% to 41%.
Yeah.
A massive fall. And the Democratic Alliance, which started off just winning Cape Town in 1994, now has the whole of the Western Cape and a lot of the metros and other areas across the country, which is the party you and I would probably vote for, which is the sort of center, free market, center right. They're not center right, they're center. You know. They went from almost nothing in 1994 to 22% in 2024. But things are collapsing. Our infrastructure is collapsing. Our roads have potholes. Anywhere outside of the Western Cape, which is run by the Democratic Alliance, is falling apart. There's sewage on the streets. There's sewage being pumped into the ocean. You know, people go without water for days on end. People in cities. And Johannesburg, the most powerful economic unit in Africa, is falling apart. So we have municipal elections coming in 2027, February, and our next national elections in 2029. We have to survive till then. And you asked me about pessimism and optimism. I'm very pessimistic over the next 3 years, 4 years, very pessimistic. South Africa is going to get worse and worse and worse. But after 2029 is where there's light at the end of the tunnel. But what we need in 2029, the ANC to go from 40% to 20%, and the Democratic Alliance and allies to go from 21, 22 to 40, and then in some form of coalition to over 50. That is our only chance on a local level. But we haven't talked internationally yet.
Yes, we'll go to Trump then in a bit, because I'm interested to hear more about farm murders.
Yeah.
Because we have all these, you mentioned that the ANC's support has decreased. And from my understanding, Cyril Ramaphosa has started placating some other problematic voices to stay in power that are chanting genocidal messages, like shoot the boar, kill the boar, shoot the farmer, and they're dancing as if that's something that is acceptable. And also, I'm incredibly mad when I see lots of leftists here saying that everything is hate speech. If you criticize us, it's hate speech. But somehow saying shoot the boar isn't hate speech. So how did this happen?
Okay, so during what they call the struggle,
the
liberation against apartheid, they did sing those songs.
Yeah.
And because our judiciary has been captured by ANC loyalists, I'd say 60 to 70% of the High Court and other judges in South Africa are either stupid, incompetent, or are loyal to the ANC, decisions will go in their favor. And AfriForum, a very prominent civil rights organization, which started off as an Afrikaans organization, now it's pan-South Africa, representing all groups and all peoples, all minorities, took this case to the High Court.
Yeah.
And the High Court decided it was not hate speech. It was a liberation song. But this is being challenged again, because that was a compromised decision. Whenever Julius Malema and his Red Berets of the economic freedom fighters, which has nothing to do with economy or freedom.
They're like just People's Republic just of North
hard,
Korea. Yeah.
Exactly. They're a hard left, communist, opportunist, money-grabbing organization. And they, by the way, have about, I think they're at 8-9% of the vote. It's out of 60 million people. That's still quite a lot of people that support them.
Yeah.
They're the ones jumping up and down in stadiums, 90,000 people singing, shouting, kill the boer, kill the farmer. One settler, one bullet. And farm murders spike, farm attacks spike after these incidents. So they're directly linked. But let me give you a statistic. There are, on average, a farm attack a day in South Africa and a farm murder one per week. It is three times more likely to be killed as a farmer in South Africa than as a policeman. And it's twice as likely to be murdered as a policeman than as an average citizen. So being a farmer is the most dangerous profession in South Africa. And three important Afrikaners went to the White House recently, and they came back with a message from the White House. South Africa, if you want to avoid tariffs, which start August the 1st, and sanctions, which are going to be targeted on individuals in the ANC and EFF and MK, you need to adhere to a number of things. One, farm attacks need to be made a priority crime and something needs to be done about them. Two, black economic empowerment needs to be repealed and the 600 American companies operating in South Africa should not be subject to it. Three, expropriation without compensation needs to be repealed and replaced with expropriation with market compensation. So it's pretty clear what America wants and what the majority of South Africans want, because the South African government, the ANC government, is not speaking on behalf of South Africans.
Do you think that's enough? And the reason I'm asking is because, to my mind, yes, if I were threatened with this, I would listen. But yeah. if we are talking about a government that thinks it's a good idea to talk about expropriation without compensation, it seems to me that their understanding of economics isn't particularly good. So how strong is a threat about tariffs to them?
Here's the thing that people don't understand. The ANC don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah.
They just want to steal. They know they've got 4 years left. They want to steal as much as they can, as quickly as they can. Yeah. It's 100 families. They're stealing the country blind. They don't care what happens to the average South African. And the average South African needs to wake up, stop being so stupid, and realize the ANC is the enemy, not the friend.
Yeah.
And that they're being bribed with social grants. Those 100 families need to be named and shamed.
So when it comes to the rhetoric of white genocide, I've heard lots of people talking about it, and there has always been this effort from mainstream media, but also leftist organizations and sides, to portray this as a right-wing extremist myth. What's the reality
when it comes to Israel and Gaza?
What's the reality behind it?
So if you look at the United Nations definition of genocide, there are 10 elements. There's classification, organization, persecution, all leading to extermination. There are 10 elements of it.
Yeah.
And denial is one of them, by the way.
Yeah.
If you look at those 10 elements, about 7 of them are relevant in South Africa. There's certainly economic genocide taking place against whites, coloreds, and Indians, and certain black tribes. But in terms of lighting the ovens to systematically kill people, that isn't happening.
Yeah.
But farmers are targeted, white people are targeted, Indian people of colored extraction are being targeted. The ANC is instituting it slowly and have been doing it for a number of years, but it's coming to a fall. And when they spoke about expropriation without compensation, Cyril Ramaphosa said, we're unlikely ever to use it. Then why put it in place?
Yeah.
And I describe it as having a loaded gun in the bedroom on your side dresser. At some point, one of the kids running around is going to pick that gun up and pull the trigger.
Pardon me for saying this, but his rhetoric seems to me a bit childish.
He's a moron.
Yeah.
He's spineless.
Yeah.
He's pathetic. I'll give you an example. A very senior policeman in KZN, one of our provinces, came out of the blue and announced how much corruption there is in the police and that the Minister of Police is enabling it. Yeah. Boom, it was like a shock to the system, okay? People couldn't believe this guy had the courage to front up and say it. Cyril Ramaphosa, what does he do? Announces a commission. What a pathetic human being. Announces a commission. Now you know what's gonna happen.
Who's gonna be on it?
Who's gonna be on it? How much time are they gonna spend? How much money are they gonna spend? And nothing's going to happen to the conclusions of the commission.
Yeah.
The biggest commission South Africa's had since 1994 was the Zondo Commission. Okay, this extraordinary man Zondo spent 4 years, billions of rand. He interviewed thousands of people and he named and shamed criminals, gangsters in the Zondo Commission. What has happened since then? Nothing. Nothing.
Yeah.
Cyril Ramaphosa believes the way to deal with issues, form a commission, and then people will forget about it, or people will lose interest in X number of years' time. And it works, because South Africans are suffering from PTSD. If you open the newspaper in South Africa, they don't even say 85 murders today, which is, by the way, the number, 50 rapes, 85 murders every day, because people are just exhausted. They're tired, they're PTSD. We're like frogs being boiled in a pot.
It's like getting used to it, and so you get desensitized.
Correct. You desensitize or you just stay in your bubble, so I can't deal with it.
Yeah.
Until something happens to you, you just try and block it out. Because my wife's a New Zealander. She loves South Africa. She loves Cape Town, doesn't want to leave. My kids love it. And she says, why don't South Africans go out on the streets and start protesting and march up to Pretoria and throw these ANC gangsters out of power? Well, the reality is you either put yourself in a bubble and just keep going, because it's a fabulous country. or you leave the country.
And I suspect it's not very easy for every Afrikaner to do so.
Well, Trump's offered a lifeline, this refugee. Yeah. You can apply as a refugee to go to America. But, you know, they've been there since 1650. Yeah. People have been there 13, 14 generations. They don't want to leave. We want to fix our country and make it better. And our chance comes in 2029 on a democratic election, municipal elections, where the Democratic Alliance hopefully will win Johannesburg. And that's going to be the big break for the ANC. Then they're going to start unraveling.
Well, when rapidly. Is when are these elections?
February 2027. Municipals, yes. Nationals in 2029. We have to survive till then. You know, I landed from London this morning, and a number of people came up and said, Rob, love to meet you. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for giving us a voice. Two different people. I said, oh, do you live in Cape Town? No, we're going to America. On holiday? No, we're leaving, immigrating. Two different families this morning.
Yeah.
So it's a rout. And it's not just white families leaving. A lot of colored Indian black families too. Any educated person in South Africa has to be looking at the country and going, this is trending in the wrong direction.
It's unsustainable. Badly. Yeah. To what extent do you think that changing the country is an issue of political will? Because I'm in political commentary, let's say, and I'm of the opinion that most issues are issues of political will. We don't have to constantly change philosophical worldviews and start by writing books or reading fringe literature that was forgotten for a reason. I think to a large extent, it's an issue of political will. Do you disagree with this? How would this play out in South Africa?
So here are the main political parties. The ANC at 40%. The Democratic Alliance at 21%, and then two spin-off parties from the ANC. MK, Mkhonto weSizwe, which is Jacob Zuma returning. It's like the Zuma family dynasty, and they're at 15%. And then the monsters of the economic freedom fighters, Julius Malema, at 8-9%. But if you tally those up, if you take ANC, MK, and EFF, you're over 50% of people voting for racist and socialist parties that will destroy our economy. So you have to think to yourself, you know, is the voting population that stupid, that evil to want, do they not understand what's happening? And the only thing where political will is coming through is at the service delivery level. I know this sounds basic, but if you don't get water, you don't get electricity, your roads aren't fixed, and your kids aren't being educated, at some point the penny drops and you realize this isn't working. Maybe we need a Malay.
I think we definitely need a Malay.
Everyone needs a Malay.
Every country needs a Malay. Yeah. But my pessimistic side comes into it here. As
you're an optimist, though.
I am, but I'm trying to think of the issue from multiple sides because I want to be a realist also. There are lots of people who are deprived of these goods or access of these goods in countries that have communist propaganda.
Correct.
And it looks like they carry on with what goes on, or they are afraid to support alternatives. And you have described South Africa as a country that has suffered from communist propaganda for decades, which is also something that has led to state capture.
Yeah.
And to what extent is the culture ready to understand this? And not only to understand it, but also see an alternative that is realistic.
So I've talked about the service delivery level.
Yeah.
Even people in Johannesburg that have been supporting the ANC are thinking this isn't working. Yeah. Nothing's working.
Yeah.
The ANC is at fault. The penny is starting to drop. The democratic system is moving with glacial speed in the right direction.
Okay, good.
But after 30 years in power, the black majority picking on the white, colored, and Indian minority, okay, unusual, it's usually the other way around, are using the excuse so that they're not blamed, that it's apartheid, whiteness that's holding them back.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the average voter and the average person in the street actually believes that anymore. That's You've good. Had a black majority in power for 30 years, and now, only now, do you blame apartheid, colonialism, and whiteness. I mean, what crap is that?
I was watching a video about South Africa, and it was a leftist from South Africa talking, and the very language they used was language I would hear to university. And I was an academic, and there were people talking like that. So instantly I asked myself, is this person educated in Western universities? And where has that vocabulary and this phraseology come from? Are they speaking to an audience outside the country as opposed to the everyday person?
Yes, they are. South Africans tend not to be ideological. 88% of South Africans are Christian.
Yeah.
Or Christian derivative.
Yeah.
88%. And are very conservative.
Yeah.
And are church-going. And are slow-moving. There's this expression called a gogo. A gogo is a grandmother who was born under apartheid, saw the ANC as their liberation, and is in their 50s, 60s, 70s now, still voting for the ANC. And there's this belief that once the gogos realize the ANC is actually doing a worse job than for them under apartheid, only then will the tide shift against them. And it's happening now.
Yeah.
But we've got four more years to sit it out. So these lunatic leftists in South Africa that are promoting net zero to a country that's got tons of coal, that are promoting CRT, that are promoting all these evil cultural Marxist, you know, initiatives, are they're not getting traction other than in the universities, as you'd expect. So the most South Africans are capitalist. If you go to the townships and the Soweto's and the Alexanders, you know, where the traditionally black areas where the apartheid separated whites and blacks, and these are the black areas, they've become thriving economic metropolises. I mean, you don't have big glass buildings yet, but you've got fantastic entrepreneurs, business people. And we need them to vote because currently they are capitalists to the extreme.
Yeah.
Communism has no sway in South Africa. South Africans will never be truly communist. It's this nonsense concept that's being peddled that doesn't have traction and shouldn't and won't.
I actually really like what you're saying because it seems to falsify a stereotype I may have had in my mind. Because the question would be, if we do think that South Africa needs a Milei and someone to implement freer market policies, or perhaps it's not going to be the extreme ideological free market of some philosophers' imagination.
We're pretty free market in South Africa. It's pretty capitalist.
Because I was going to ask that, you know, to what extent is there a cultural background that can support free market institutions keeping promises, contracts, enforcing contracts, honoring
It's all there. It's been weakened, diminished, undermined. We're massively overregulated. We have a first world overregulated economy when we should be trying to accelerate economic growth, make it easier for people to start businesses and be successful.
Yeah.
You know, too many lawyers, too many regulators, too many politicians. Just like New Zealand and Australia.
Yes.
You know, it makes you sick. So we need a Malay to we need a department, a DOGE, Department of Deregulation, desperately.
Yeah.
We need to cut costs. Do you know we have 32 cabinet ministers? 32.
Yeah, that's
and
a lot.
And we have, I think, 34, 35 deputy ministers. It's a joke. We have more generals per capita than any other military in the world. It's jobs for friends.
Yes. Right. So it seems to me that the second Trump presidency does exert a kind of pressure to South Africa's government at the moment, which may be positive. What's plan B for South Africa if the Democrats win the 2028 election, and rather than someone like J.D. Vance or someone like...
Heaven help us. Heaven help the world.
Yeah, someone else or and loses to someone like AOC or Gavin Newsom.
Oh, we're over.
What's next for South Africa?
I'm moving to Argentina.
Okay.
What a nightmare. Don't that'll keep me up at night. So what's happening right now is tariffs hit South Africa August 1st of 30%.
Yeah.
Okay. That's going to demolish we were hoping for. 4 months ago, our finance minister had a budget of 1.5% economic growth. He said two more budgets, both being pushed back by the Democratic Alliance. He's under 1%. The minute tariffs hit, we're going to be down to almost zero. We may even get 40% because he's saying 30% on South Africa and 10% on BRICS countries. So it could be 40%.
Yeah.
And that's bye-bye to our textile industry, our fruit, meats, wheat, car industry. I mean, very, very worrying. But what's more interesting is Congressman Ronnie Jackson of Texas is putting a bill into Congress now. It's just passed the committee vote where America plans to sanction using SDN list, asset freezes, Magnitsky Act, individuals in the ANC and other proponents of anti-Americanism, anti-Semitism, hate speech and kleptocracy and gangsters, not just in the ANC, but the MK and EFF and others in South Africa. Now, they don't know what's going to hit them.
Yeah.
I mean, that is not, if you wire money from your bank to another bank and there's an American-linked intermediary bank, your money's frozen. They can't fly to Western countries on Western flights. Bring it on.
So I have three last questions. Mm. And one is, what do farmers do in the meantime? Because if you are saying, and to be fair, this is what to a degree you can say, that change will come towards 2029. In the meantime, if there is one farm murder per week, and I'm a farmer, what should I think of? How do I guard myself? How do I minimize the how do I protect myself better? How do I minimize the chances of
surviving?
Killed.
Yeah. It's all about survival. So farmers are isolated with load shedding, which is when you don't have electricity, alarm systems go down. The police and army are not incentivized to protect farmers because they're captured by the ANC. And the ANC say, oh, this is a very violent country. Our farm attacks are nothing special. Not true, Cyril Ramaphosa. And Trump made it very clear when he said, dim the lights and showed that video in front of Cyril, embarrassing Cyril and his pathetic entourage in the White House. Farmers have to survive. I think the farm community in South Africa has gone from 120,000 to 30,000 commercial farmers. So farmers have left in droves. And it's not just white farmers being attacked. Black farmers too.
Yeah.
It's horrific. And people say, yeah, but it's not politically motivated. Well, maybe a lot of it's economic and they're isolated and that's where the money is. But the fact that so many of them are raped, tortured, and murdered in the most horrific way, and these things spike after Malema and his crowd are doing their kill the Boer speeches, means there is a political dimension to it. So farmers have to survive. South Africans, every 5 years when they're at the edge of collapse and we seem to come through. It's still a great place to visit.
Yes. Okay. I'll definitely ask you afterwards where to visit.
And, Cape Town. Start in Cape Town.
Okay, great. So here's my next question, and I would really like if you could expand on it a bit and tell us what you think. What does the case of South Africa, if South Africa's case right now is a case study, what does it have to teach other Western nations about what not to do, what to take seriously, and what don't they take seriously, and what should they be definitely focused on to not end up in such a situation?
Firstly, don't just assume that if the country is a democracy, everything's okay. You can still have deep malevolence infiltrating democracy at all levels, and this element of state and democracy and judiciary capture is real. There are real democracies and fake democracies. Zimbabwe pretends it's a democracy, but the result every year.
Yeah.
So in South Africa, you have a malevolent organization and kleptocratic organization that has infiltrated every level of democracy and is picking on the minorities. Trump has stood up, the only leader has stood up and said, I'm not allowing this to happen. I'm going to do something about it. Let's take Britain, where I am right now. I have a friend in the House of Lords who's a crossbencher. Now, to me, crossbencher now means wanker, if I'm allowed to swear on your show. And he said to me, I said, why aren't you doing something about it? Why aren't you guys standing up and calling out what's going on in South Africa? Just read the Zondo Commission and say, this isn't right. And he goes, we believe in soft diplomacy.
Yeah.
Soft diplomacy is a concept for weaklings and is a concept for losers. Just because you're too scared to say boo to a black leader in South in Africa means they laugh in your face. And to my friend who's in the House of Lords, grow some cojones and tell it like it is, please, on behalf of all your friends in South Africa.
The issue with democracy that I'm really worried about, especially with fake democracies, because is that it seems to me that right now there are lots of people in Western democracies who think that all of them can live like oligarchs, or all of them can live like aristocrats. And they treat the state as a sort of mechanism that would allow them to do this.
Which has happened in South Africa.
Which reinforces the philosophy of looting and overregulation and excessive intervention in the economy, which ends up creating an economic meltdown and disaster.
Correct, 100% right.
And also cultural one.
Just because something's a democracy doesn't mean it's good and it's okay and you don't have to, and you don't have to look at it and you can look the other way. You know, everyone like Mandela legacy, it's a democracy, South Africa's solved.
Yeah.
Let's go and find another problem to solve. Not the case. Look at our country now.
The way I tell people is monarchy, oligarchy and democracy is an answer to the question, how many people make decisions?
Exactly.
You still have to make the right decision.
Exactly.
And a decision-making body.
I mean, South Africa, I hate to say it, is desperate for a Malay, is desperate for a benevolent dictator.
Yeah.
Desperate. We're not going to fix it unless we get that.
And when it comes to this question as a sub question, do you think that Western countries right now, like England and other like Germany, France, they are afraid to assert a sort of, you know, European identity, let's say, not the European, pan-European, as opposed to, you know, the regional one, but do you think that they think like mere economic zones and not economy of the good type? And
correct.
That this creates a sort of multicultural failure.
And that South Africa laughs.
You can't rule by saying soft diplomacy is an end in itself.
Correct.
Yeah.
South Africa laughs at Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, Europe and America are South Africa's biggest trading partners. There's stronger cultural, economic, and other links between America and Europe and South Africa than ANC's favorite brothers and comrades in Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. Big issue. So, but the West doesn't use its power. It doesn't flex its muscles. Only Donald Trump has done it. You know, Western Europe is pathetically weak, and soft diplomacy when it comes to South Africa doesn't work. They laugh at Europe.
And do you think that this is, to a very large extent, self-imposed, which has to do with communist subversion, which manifested initially with anti-economic, anti-capitalism, and then with all the crazy DEI stuff, anti-Western, anti-white, anti-whatever.
Yeah, and a shame and a bit afraid of being white. We can't tell these black African countries that they're pathetic losers because we would be lording over them. It's true. Most of them are pathetic losers.
And I want to end with this question with a positive note. what is your vision for South Africa? What if you were to get power and do good, what would you want South Africa to become like? So what do you think South Africa can become like?
I want South Africa, I'm going to give you your gift now.
Yes.
I want South Africa to become like the Springbok rugby team, okay?
Yeah.
We've won the last two Rugby World Cups, and the reason being...
Thank you very much.
The reason being is because thanks to our incredible rugby management team, a man called Rassie Erasmus and his team, he has brought extraordinary people of all colours and races and creeds into the Springbok rugby team, and we are world beaters. Our country can be the same, but we need to be merit-based, and we need to be positive, work together, and make stuff happen. It can be done.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hersov, it has been a pleasure interviewing you. Thank you very much.
Stelios, what a great pleasure. Great. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.